Okay, so I'm going to talk about Fourier spectrum of Boolean functions, and mainly about the applications of Fourier analysis in discrete mathematics. So there are many problems in many areas of discrete mathematics that are solved using Fourier analysis techniques. So, for example, additive number theory is probably the main area that there are many, most of the best bounds are obtained using Fourier analysis. There are some problems in combinatorics recently in complexity theory, discrete geometry, and graph theory. So in all these problems, we usually have some correlation type phenomena. So we want to prove that two structures have some correlation, or we want to prove that a set which has certain properties has a close structure, its structure is close to some set A. So we want to prove some kind of correlation. So let's just define the Fourier expansion for the simplest group Z2 to the n. So here we think of Z to the n as just the set minus 1, 1 to the n. So every element of this group is just an n tuple, and every coordinate has only two possible values, minus 1 and 1. And we have a function from this set to set of complex numbers. So f is a function from minus 1, 1 to the n to set of complex numbers. Then we can write f as the linear combination of these functions ws, which I'm going to tell you what are they. And these f hat of s, these are just some complex numbers. These are the Fourier coefficients, which are just some numbers, and ws is a function. And the sum goes over all subsets of the set of numbers 1 to n. So s is a subset of n. And ws is just the product of the coordinates inside s. So for example, take this function f of x here, 2 minus 3x1, 2 minus minus 2x3 minus 5x1 x2. So we define w of empty sets to be the constant 1. So for 2, I write in the above notation, we'll have 2 w empty sets. And x1 is just w1. x3 is just w3. And x1, x2 is w1 and 2. So that's just the Fourier expansion of f in this setting. So the Fourier expansion has certain properties. For example, it can be easily shown that the Fourier coefficients are unique. So you can't have two different way to write the Fourier expansion. Okay, and So we can extract some certain information easily from the Fourier expansion. For example, let's take the expected value of f. So we pick a random x, and we want to know what is the expected value of f of x. These ws of x, these functions, have expected value 0. So if you take the expected value of f, all these ws's will become 0, except w empty set. W empty set is just a constant. So we'll get this second item here, that expected value of f of x is just f hat of empty set. And the reason is that for every s which is not equal to empty set, the expected value of that corresponding function, ws, is 0. So all of them will be canceled out. And the second useful fact is that the expected value of the f of x squared is just the sum of the Fourier coefficients squared. And the reason is that these WS, WTs have some orthogonal properties. So the expected value of WS, WT is equal to 1 when S is equal to T, and it's 0 otherwise. So if you just multiply F to itself and take the expected value, only these terms will remain. Other ones will become 0. And so from these two, of course, the variance of F is just the sum of these F hat of S squares over all non MTS. So we can write the Fourier expansion in a similar way for every abelian group G. So the Fourier expansion of a function f from G to C, where G is an abelian group, is a finite abelian group is just this sum, where this chi of S is analog of WS. So the sum goes over all elements of the group, and these chi of S are some functions, and f hat of S is just a complex number. So one of the first applications of the Fourier analysis in discrete math is by a beautiful proof by Roth. It's about arithmetic progressions in sets of integers. So we have this beautiful proof of van der Waarden, which says that if you have a large n and you color the elements of this set 1 to n with C colors, where C is a constant, then you'll get a color class which has an arithmetic progression of size k. So for every k, you can find a large enough n such that you have this property. If you color the set with C colors, then you can find a monochromatic arithmetic progression. The bounds which is obtained by van der Waarden's proof is awfully bad. It's Ackermann function. So if you consider that the bound or not. So Erdős and Turan looked at van der Waarden's theorem, and they thought that maybe the reason for existence of the arithmetic progression is that there is some color class of large enough size. So it's not really about coloring. It's about that when you color with C colors, then you'll have a color class which is of size n over C. So they conjectured that for every positive delta and k, integer k, there is some large enough n so that every large subset of 1 to n, so the size of A is more than delta n, then A contains an arithmetic progression of size k. So of course this conjecture will imply van der Waarden's theorem, but it seems it's more difficult, much more difficult. So the conjecture remained open until in 53, Roth proved the conjecture only for k equal to 3. And the proof uses Fourier analysis, and it's one of the first proofs, I think, in discrete math, Fourier analytic proofs in discrete math. So let's see how Roth's proof goes. So to simplify things, we look at Zn instead of the set 1 to n. So here there is a difference, because in Zn you can have these sums that, for example, 1 plus n minus 1 is equal to 0, but it's a minor technical thing and it can be removed from the problem, so that's not very important. So let's take a random subset of this 1 to n, random subset of Zn, and see how many arithmetic progressions of size 3 we can get from it. So the expected value is delta 3 n squared, and the reason for that is, so we are looking for these x plus r, x plus 2r. And so we have n choices for x, n choices for r. That's n squared. And we want all these three elements to be in the set. And the probability that each one of them is in the set is delta. So we get delta 3 n squared number of arithmetic progressions. We expect to see that many arithmetic progressions in a random set. And that's too many. That we need only one. So to use Fourier analysis, we have to go from discrete case to analytic case. And we just define a simple function, which is 1 if x is inside A and 0 if x is not inside A. The characteristic function of A. So this simple function will enable us to use analytic techniques. We go from discrete case to analytic case. Now we want to work with functions. So let's see what happens to Fourier coefficients when we pick A at random. So F hat of 0, again, it's just the expected value of A, expected value of F, similar to the Z2 to the N case. So F hat of 0 will be delta. So we can't do anything about that. It's just because of the size of A. But all the other Fourier coefficients will be very small, because these WS functions, you saw that their expected value is 0, or here their expected value is 0, and they're concentrated around 0. So all other Fourier coefficients will be small with high probability. So that's for a random set. So the idea is, Roth's idea was to distinguish between these two cases. When your set is similar to a random set in the above sense, that all the Fourier coefficients are small. And the case that there is one large Fourier coefficient. So we have to deal with these two cases. So let's consider the first case. Suppose that for every S not equal to 0, the Fourier coefficient corresponding to that is very small. It's less than some alpha, which alpha is a constant, but small constant. So we are looking for A, B, 2, B minus A is inside A. That's the general arithmetic regression. We want to find some A, B, 2, B minus A inside A. So we want to count the number of these arithmetic progressions. How can we do that? That's just n squared times expected value of this thing here. Why? Because F was the characteristic function of A. So when A, B, and 2B minus A are inside A, this thing will become 1, this thing inside the bracket, and otherwise it's 0. So this expected value will give the expected number of arithmetic progressions. We'll give the number of arithmetic progressions, but we have to multiply it by n squared because we take the expected value. This will be a number between 0 and 1. So that's just the simple counting of the number of arithmetic progressions of size 3. But so it's very easy to see that this expected value is nothing but this expression here. It's just the first term is, remember that was the expected number of arithmetic progressions of length 3 inside a random set. So this is the part for a random set, and we get this extra thing here, n squared times the sum over Fourier coefficient. So we have a very nice expression for the number of 3 times arithmetic progressions according to F. And now from now on, it's very easy. We factor out the maximum Fourier coefficient from this sum, so we get this maximum of F hat of 0, and then we apply Cauchy-Schwarz inequality to the rest of the sum, so we'll get this thing here. But we have that both of these things are less than 1, because we saw that the sum of the Fourier coefficient squared was variance of F, and F was the Boolean function. So this is at most 1, and we bounded the maximum Fourier coefficients, right? We assume that every Fourier coefficient is less than alpha. So what we get here is alpha times n squared. So the total number of arithmetic progressions is positive when alpha is less than delta 3. Right, so this case is easily done. So we prove that when all Fourier coefficients are small, we have a lot of 3 terms arithmetic progressions. For the other case, when there is a large Fourier coefficient, it's slightly more complicated, but it's not very complicated again. And In that case, we prove that we have a large correlation with some large arithmetic progression. Not large correlation. We have a positive correlation with a large arithmetic progression. Which means that, so what we do is, so we know that there exists some large Fourier coefficient. We look for the reason for that, why this Fourier coefficient is large. And from that, we derive that we have a large intersection with a large arithmetic progression. Right? And now we go inside that arithmetic progression, inside this arithmetic progression P, and we look for three terms arithmetic progression in the intersection. So we look for three terms arithmetic progressions inside A intersection B P. And we know that this intersection is large comparing to the size of P. So we, by repeatedly applying this, we can boost the density so much that we trivially find some three terms arithmetic progression. And Roth's proof gave a very reasonable bound for the value of n comparing to van der Waarden's Ackermann bound. And the bound later improved by Borgain, and that's the best known bound for three terms arithmetic progression. So the conjecture remained open again until in 69, Zanardi proved the conjecture for case k equal to 4. But his proof is completely combinatorial and uses Zemerdi's his own regularity lemma, which he developed for this problem. And but the thing about his proof is that it uses van der Waarden's theorem, so it, again, the bound is terribly bad. In 74, he generalizes his proof to the general case and settled Erdős-Thoráns conjecture. So, and then in 75, Furstenberg gave another proof for the problem using ergodic theory. Again, the bound is bad, uses van der Waarden theorem, but the good thing about this proof is that it implies a lot of similar results, more general results. So again, people were trying to generalize Roth's proof because to get a good bound, it seemed that that was the only way that's known to us to do that. And it wasn't easy until in 98, Gavers finally generalized that proof for general K and gave a third proof for Zemerdi's theorem, but with a better bound. Again, the bound is double exponential. It's not really good, but it's much better than Ackermann function. So, what Gavers did was he defined a new notion of pseudorandomness. Here we saw that the random sets had small Fourier coefficients, and we somehow took that as the definition of a random set. So we considered all sets with small Fourier coefficients and as random sets, and we distinguished between that and the other case. But that doesn't work for the larger value of K, because you can have sets with all small Fourier coefficients, but with no four-term arithmetic progression. So probably the most difficult part in the proof of Gavers was to come up with some notion of pseudorandomness that works for general K. So again, the rest of the proof has the same flavor of Roth. We have this correlation with large arithmetic progressions, and we look inside A intersection P in the other case. So for this problem, we needed to prove that there is some small correlation with some arithmetic progression P. There are some other problems that we want to prove that there is a large correlation with some structure, some function. So most of the we usually do that to obtain a stability result. So suppose that we know we have a theorem which says that any set of size M which has some property P has a structure A. So we classified all sets of size M with some property P. We know that they have a nice structure A. So we want to prove that this has some stability, in the sense that we want to prove that if the set is not of size M, but is of size slightly less than M, is of size 1 minus epsilon M, and has property P, then the structure is not exactly A, but it's approximately A. So it's A with some modifications, some error. Yeah. So usually in this, for these kind of problems, not usually, but sometimes when the structure is nice and we can relate it to abelian groups, we can apply Fourier analysis techniques. So suppose that the above scenario happens for an abelian group G, and F is the characteristic function of this structure A. So we look at the Fourier expansion of, and also the Fourier expansion of F must be nice, otherwise we can't really work with that. And then we look at the Fourier expansion of the set of size 1 minus epsilon m, which has property P. We want to show that S is approximately A. And so to define that accurately, we want to show that the symmetric difference between S and A is small. So this thing here, S, symmetric difference with A, normalized by the size of group, is small. And that's nothing but expected value of F minus G, because F and G are both characteristic functions, both take 0, 1 values. So the value of F minus G, the absolute value of F minus G, is 1 only when one of them is 1, one of them is 0, so when you have this difference here. And since this is only 0, 1 value, we can rewrite it as expected value of F minus G squared, and by the formula that we saw in the first slide, this is just nothing but this sum. So if we can show that this sum is small, we can prove the instability result. So let's see an example of this type of result. So we want to find the large independent sets inside this graph, G equal to KR to the n, which is the strong product. So what is KR to the n? The vertices are just the elements of this set, 0 to R minus 1 to n, which we identify with the groups that are to the n. So the elements are n tuples, and every coordinate is a number between 0 and R minus 1. And two nodes are adjacent if they differ in every coordinate. So that's the adjacency relation here. If x1 is not equal to y1, x2 not equal to y2, so on. So there's a result by Greenwell and Loas which says that all maximum independent sets in this graph are of this form. So this is an independent set here. You fix J and let the other coordinates vary between all, take all the possible values. Why this is an independent set? Because they all share this one coordinate, so you can't have adjacent nodes inside this set, right? Because you will violate that condition about the adjacency condition. So this is just the sets of all x such that xi is equal to j. So the result of Greenwell and Loas says that these are the only maximum independent sets. We want to show that this is a stable. So instead of the maximum independent set, we look for something that's of size slightly less than maximum, we'll get some structure that's close to this. So let's look at the Fourier expansion of the character function of this set. So the characteristic function of this set is the function again that's 1 when the element is inside the set and 0 in the other case. So the Fourier expansion is this thing. These are some numbers, and the first thing that you can see here is that all non-zero characters, all characters with non-zero coefficients, have a lot of zeros and only one non-zero element inside them. So here, for example, you have all of them zero, and T, you have this only this one, which is not zero. And T varies between all the values, between 1 and R minus 1. So define for an element inside ZR^n, define its size to be the number of non-zero coordinates of the set of this element. So here, the size of this set is 1. This element is 1 because it has only 1 non-zero coordinate. So there is a result by Frigat, Kalai, and Naur, which says that if you have this thing, if all Fourier coefficients corresponded to elements of size more than 1 are 0, then the function depends only on 1 coordinate. So we have this property for this function, right? It's all the non-zero Fourier coefficients are corresponded to elements of size 1, and this sum is 0 for this one. And we know that this function depends on only 1 coordinate. It looks at exactly ith coordinate. And there is a result by Alan Diener, Frigat, and Sudeko, which says that if I is an independent set of size 1 minus epsilon times the maximum possible, then we have this bound. This sum is less than 2 epsilon over R. So when epsilon is 0, which means that the set is a maximum independent set, this sum is equal to 0. So that should be less than or equal. The sum will be equal to 0. So from the above theorem, from this theorem, we get that the set depends on only 1 coordinate. So these two imply Greenwell and Loess's theorem. But from this, we hope to get a stability result. And Hari and I prove this theorem that if, so using Alan Diener, Frigat, and Sudeko's result, that if the size of the independent set is slightly less than maximum, then we have this bound for the symmetric difference between the independent set and one maximum independent set. So we prove that there is one of these maximum independent sets, IIJ, such that this symmetric difference is very small. So the set almost looks like one of these maximum independent sets. So there is a general rule here which says that if you have a function whose Fourier coefficients are concentrated on small values of s, like the above case, there we had the Fourier coefficients were only on the set on the s of size 1. But this is more general. That's not a theorem. It's just a general rule. Then the function is somehow less complicated. So, for example, take this function f of x is equal to just 2 times x1. This is a function which depends only on the first coordinate. And it's a very easy function. And so all the Fourier expansion is on the sets of size 1, on W1. But on the other hand, take this function, multiply all these coordinates together. So here, everything is inside the set minus 1, 1 to the n. So this is Wn. So all Fourier coefficients are on this large set n, all the numbers between 1 and n. And this is, so the people in complexity theory usually uses this as a hard function to have a, in the sense of having a small circuit. And so this is not really a mathematical thing, but so to let us make this more precise. So define HK to be this sum, the sum of the Fourier coefficients on the elements of size more than K. So this meta theorem says that if this sum is small, then the function depends on few number of coordinates, approximately, not accurately. So the reason that I put here meta theorem, because you have different abelian groups, you can put different measures on it, and this is not proved in every setting. But there are some results of this type. So this result of Frigat, Kalai, and Naur was for the case k equal to 2, so remember this sum was the sum of the Fourier coefficients and the elements of size more than or equal to k, so the result of, we can restate the result of Frigate-Kelley and Nell resistance. And there is a result by Allen, Diener, Frigate, and Sudeikis for the case, again, k equal to 2. Sorry, the first one is in that nothing group ZR to the n, it's on group Z2 to the n. And this is in the group ZR to the n. And again, so the above theorem 8 is for, works for only constant values of R, and there is this theorem and RME for large values of R. And there is a more general theorem of Burgang, which is for, it's in the group Z2 to the n, but it's for general k. So it says that if HK, this sum, is smaller than this value here, k to the minus half, minus some epsilon, then G depends on k times 10 to the k coordinates. So then the function depends essentially to some number of coordinates that only depends on k, not n. And so it has some, they call these functions as dictatorships, because the value of some few number of coordinates determine the value of the whole of the function, the whole function. So there is one open problem which I'm interested in, which is to generalize Burgang's theorem for P bias product measure. So all the results that I mentioned here is for uniform measures. So the group, there is no difference between the elements of the group. They have the same weight when you take the difference between the sets, when you compare two sets. So the P bias product measure is just every coordinate is 1, take is 1 with probability P, and 0 with probability 1 minus P. And we want to obtain some results similar to Burgang, that when the function depends on few number of coordinates. There are partial results by Kindler, Safran, and by me, but I think they're far from being sharp. Burgang's theorem is sharp because if you take the majority function, it takes the majority, it's the voting system, and so we hope that it doesn't depend on the opinion of few number of people. So it's a well-separated function. And the bound of Burgang's theorem is sharp for that function. So you can't improve Burgang's theorem, but for this P bias case, we know very less about the problem. Yeah.